Me.
Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this,
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit TrinitySchool.org for more info now.
Oh, welcome to Behind the Bastards, a podcast about the worst people in all of history. And also, at the same time, a podcast where I explore my Boston accent and see how much better I can make it. And to help me today, we have professional Boston coach, Jeff May. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Hey there, kid. What's going on?
Wow. Incredible.
You see
now,
that?
Of course, yeah. I prefer to do my accent a little bit more authentic. Let me run this one by you, Jeff.
Oh, God.
Oi! Crikey! I'm from Boston!
Jeez, that's more of a North Shore accent.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like
that's what a
you're
lot
close.
Of people say.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that's very much if you were to go up to like Malden or something, like really get up there. That's where you have that. Yeah.
So
the regional dialect is wild out there.
Critical question. Brockton, yes. Part of Boston or not?
Yeah, of course. I mean, really?
So that you're on Jamie's side of this. How much is she paying you?
But let me
cackle was for, in honor of Jamie, but
well, here's the thing though.
Thank you, Jeff.
Is that I live 3,000 miles away from my hometown, right? So if where I am now and people ask where I'm from, I tell them Boston. In reality, I'm from a small farming hamlet in central Massachusetts called Charlton, regionally related to Worcester, Massachusetts. So it's hard for me when people are like, Jeff's from Boston. And I'm like, yeah. And then when someone presses me a little bit, I'm like, okay, not really though. But I've always counted, I mean, because Brockton's like the sort of heart of fighting in Boston, which is something that I did
That makes sense.
So I relate that
as being
like. I've
been in Brockton once and I did want to fight somebody.
Everyone would have fought you there.
Jeff's Boston accent was so much better than yours, Robert. I'm sorry.
His was really strong. It was strong. It wasn't regionalized but it was strong. Yeah.
Yours was very Marky Mark.
Macky Mac.
Yeah. Ugh,
the friggin' Wahlberg. You should do an episode on him.
That was so good.
The only people that like the Wahlbergs are the people that are related to the Wahlbergs.
Have you ever eaten at a Wahlburgers?
I would rather fucking die.
It is absolutely.
Is that a real place?
I don't want to be mean, but it is the worst burger I've ever had in my entire life.
Well, so, you know, I think a Mark Wahlberg getting a burger chain is evidence of one of the many crimes of capitalism. And you know who hated capitalism?
Oh.
Donnie Wahlberg.
That might be true, but also the subject of today's episode, Nicolae Ceaușescu, dictator of Romania.
We just start doing an entire thing about the Wahlberg family and never get to the actual topic. I wouldn't put that.
Yeah. I could do it. I could do an hour.
I know
related
you could.
Bastards. I mean, we are talking about one corrupt family and another corrupt family. So the Ceaușescus and the Wahlbergs, who has caused more death and destruction?
So, Robert,
impossible to say.
I need you to say welcome to and you're ready for it. Go behind the bastards.
Welcome to behind the bastards.
No, that's not it.
That was, you nailed it.
Thank
Don't
you.
Encourage him.
Thank you, Jeff.
I got to be 100%. Like, I thought that you had just replayed what I said back to me.
Yeah, yeah. I've been practicing my mimicry, like whatever kind of bird mimics things.
You're like a mockingjay. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Jeff, what do you know about Nicolae Ceaușescu?
I try to not know as much as I can about Romanian people. I know that he wore a lot of nylon sweatsuits. He had a lot of cologne on.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you want, I mean, because Romania is kind of like edge of the Balkans, right? Sometimes it's considered part of the Balkans. Some people will be like, nah, it's Eastern Europe. It's not really in the whatever. This is not the place to litigate that. But what I can say about Romanians, which I can also say about Serbians and Bosnians and a number of other people in that area, is that their tracksuit game is incredibly strong.
Unbelievable. It's like they're like extras in The Sopranos. Yeah.
It's amazing. If you want if you've got an Adidas, a good Adidas tracksuit in that part of the world, you're basically a king. Just squatting and smoking cigarettes, it rules. Romania is an interesting country. And Nicolae Ceaușescu is interesting because, you know, we've got all these like communist dictators like Stalin, who there are a lot of folks today, particularly on the internet, who will defend these guys. A lot of like weird authoritarian communists who have never met a dictator they don't like. And one of the things that's interesting about our subject today, Ceaușescu, is that he is the one that no one will defend. I mean, I'm sure you can find a couple of Ceaușescu stands out there, but almost nobody will back this guy up because he sucked so comprehensively.
It's funny. When you look at the old Soviet bloc and you look at like some of the dictators they had and you look at the older people that lived through it, and they're like, well, you know, sometimes you have to make hard decisions. And it's like the guy killed like 100,000 people. And they're like, well, you know, ruling is difficult. It is very interesting to see the apologists of like the really terrible people in Russia. They're just like, sometimes you settle for a despot. It happens. I like his fate was sealed on, I believe, if I recall correctly.
Oh yes.
Christmas.
Yeah. He was him being murdered was a Christmas present for the whole Romanian nation, right? And really the world, but we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. So we're going to talk about Nicolae Ceaușescu, but we're also going to have to talk about Romania and give some history, because I don't think most Americans know a lot about Romania. It's a part of the world that, you know, it's interesting because like there was a period of time where Ceaușescu was kind of like the good communist. He was very close friends with Richard Nixon. He was spoken of positively by Ronald Reagan. It's amazing. He's like a Stalinist who Nixon loved, and Reagan was like, he's a good guy. It's wild stuff.
Those are two people whose endorsements I could go without.
Yeah. Yeah. But before we get into how he came to power and what he did, we're going to have to talk a little bit of history, because there's some context that is important if you're going to understand
Do you know that he was, when he was younger, he was extremely hot?
That we can discuss, Sophie. I definitely don't see that, because he looks like a Muppet as he gets older.
He ages like a Muppet. Yeah, that's Romania.
A hot Muppet.
Yeah, it's the land of the Muppets. Yeah. Well, it was known as Dacia, D-A-C-I-A, back in the day, in like the classical period. If you've ever seen, like, read a book about the Roman Empire, and it talks about them fighting the Dacians and conquering the Dacians, that's Romania prior to Roman contact. Dacia is like one of the last provinces that gets conquered by the Roman Empire, and it's one of the first they abandon. So they're only hang around there for a little bit less than 300 years, and then they leave in 275 BC.
I do like the fuck this energy that they bring to living in Romania.
Yeah. It's too dark, too many mountains. Yeah. There's like vampires are going to be a thing here.
They're like, we conquered a lemon. We got to get the hell out of here.
Yeah. Well, they kind of get out of here. Obviously, like we talk about, oh, the Roman Empire conquers this place or leaves this place. 275 BC, when the Roman Empire leaves, most people living in the region probably would not have noticed much of a change. Because for one thing, they're still trading with the Romans. There's still a lot of Roman soldiers in the region. And in fact, the reason that we call it Romania now is because the like Roman soldiers who were stationed there like bred with the local population, and this is something they're pretty proud of. Like Romania, like the name Romania is kind of harkening back to the fact that there is a lot of Roman ancestry in the area now.
This ties back to for everyone that took like seventh and eighth grade languages. Remember when you would take like an introduction to like Spanish or French or Latin or whatever, and they would say, you know, whatever language you're learning, Spanish or French, they're like, they're one of the five Romance languages. That's where I'm from in Massachusetts. That's the accent. Yeah. And it's like you hear Spanish, French, Portuguese, Italian, and Romanian. And when they say Romanian, you're like, what? Like, why? Like, why them? That doesn't make sense on a map that would be the language.
Yeah, it is weird, especially since, again, if you're in that region and further into the Balkans, the language they're speaking is very different, right? But in Romania, it is this kind of like Latinized tongue. So that's cool. Roman, Romance. There's nothing as sexy as a man making a pizza and doing violent hand gestures.
I mean, you're not wrong about that.
Yeah. The center of Roman Dacia is a place that is known today as Transylvania. That's actually like the province that the Romans conquer. So again, when I say they left because of Dracula, that is historically true. Although Dracula didn't exist yet. Yeah, we're going to talk about him for just a little bit here.
Did you do have you done Vlad yet? Vlad Tepes?
No. We are kind of doing a little bit of Vlad Tepes right now.
Let me tell you real quick. I know you're about to do that, but as somebody who taught about the Middle Ages, and I used to do, for my literacy classes, I would have them write a research paper, and I'm like, you can pick anybody. I got so burnt out reading term papers from eighth graders about Vlad Tepes. And it's not that he's not interesting, it's just that it's boring when you read the same paper 30 times a year.
Well, Jeff, I'm going to try to give you a little bit different of a paper, because we're going to be focusing on an aspect of Vlad's time running Romania that people don't tend to talk about as much. Obviously, the thing everyone knows about Vlad Tepes, Vlad the Impaler, is that he impaled a bunch of people, specifically a bunch of Ottoman soldiers. And if you like hang out and read sort of the weird right-wing kind of retellings of medieval history, a lot of them will focus on him as like the shield of the West. And this is something that like within the Romanian right wing, it gets talked about a lot, that like Romania was what protected, you know, Christendom from the Ottoman Empire. And Vlad Tepes, you know, was this heroic figure who was hard enough to like keep the Muslims out.
Like this Charles is not Martel actually, in France,
this is not accurate to the actual history. Pieces of it are accurate, but the broad picture is wrong. So first off, his name was legitimately Vlad Dracula because his dad was Dracul, which was a name he got when he got given an award by the Holy Roman Emperor. I think it was Sigismund. And Dracula means son of the dragon, because Dracul means the dragon. But it also at the same time means son of the devil, which is why the guy who wrote the Dracula book thought he was a good pick for a horrible monster character name.
I like that you were like the guy. Like his name isn't.
Yeah. That dude. What's his name?
Bram.
The Dracula guy, but not Dracula.
Sharon Lewis and Bram Stoker. Yeah.
The guy who. Yeah.
From Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Shitty vampire book. The first Twilight, we could say. The prelude to Twilight. Before we really figured out what we wanted from our vampires.
Sparkles and chiseled abs.
Mm-hmm. That's right. No cum gutters on the original Dracula, probably because he was riddled with various diseases. So
I want to see Gary Oldman have like a huge six pack in that movie with that stupid little hairdo, but he's just like, check out my rippling abs.
This is the thing we should be using that AI shit to do, is go back to like movies that were made decades ago and give the male leads back then who didn't have access to modern fitness technology just unbelievably shredded cum gutters. Like go back to Gone with the Wind and throw some cum gutters in in red and throw some cum gutters on that guy who dies too. You know, the Confederate boy soldier.
Yeah, I would like to see
cum gutters all of them.
The Rock in To Kill a Mockingbird, like The Rock.
Yeah,
is
To Kill
Atticus
a Rocking
Finch.
Bird.
Yeah.
Where he actually just kills everybody in town in order to stop that guy from getting
gives them the,
tried for
the
murder.
Rock bottom as they're trying to they take out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's a good idea. Also, put Stone Cold Steve Austin in that oh shit. Now I've forgotten the name
the
of the
rails.
Movie.
Citizen Kane? We could do that.
No.
Rose
what
Barge,
is it?
The movie of a bitch. Now,
The movie where that guy goes to Washington, D.C. Mr. Smith goes to Washington.
Yeah, that man goes to Washington.
Yeah, throw Stone Cold Steve Austin in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and have him do a Stone Cold Stunner on all those old Congress fools.
What Stone Cold Smith goes to mm-hmm.
What does this have to do with our script?
Very, very little. So the actual historical Dracula, who is kind of your first... Like he's often seen as like one of kind of the founding figures of Romania in like Romanian nationalist discourse because he's kind of this first figure on the scene. And this is back when Romania is called Wallachia, who becomes super famous. And he becomes famous, for the impaling people. Vlad Tepes is the ruler of Wallachia on three non-consecutive occasions, which happens a lot, actually, in their history at this point. They've got this weird system that by which they pick who their ruler is going to be, where you have these basically this group of nobles who gets to vote on who's going to run things, and it leads to a shitload of turnover. From 1418 to 1476, Wallachia has 11 princes who are in power for about 5 years each. So he gets into power, gets thrown out of power, comes back into power several times.
Common
in Europe. But in Romania, it is a particularly like violent system. And this makes sense when you look at just kind of where Romania is located, right? Not only are they right next to the Ottoman Empire, but they're right next to Hungary and the Holy Roman Empire. And they are just constantly dealing with different groups coming in and trying to basically run things. So it's not only the Ottomans that they're fighting, and repeatedly Romanian leaders will side with the Ottomans in order to protect themselves against the Hungarians or whatever. Like this is a common thing. So Dracula, like actual Vlad Dracula, spends a decent chunk of his career fighting alongside the Ottomans. He also, for a point of it, when he's technically a vassal to the Ottomans, is leading like an illegal underground war against them. All this stuff is going on. But I think what's more to the point is that rather than kind of being a shield against like the Muslim world who is defending Christendom, Vlad is more concerned with maintaining his relative independence from an ocean of surrounding threats who covet Transylvania and the rest of Romania. Transylvania is specifically the area that the Romanians fight with the Hungarians over a lot, and it changes hands all the fucking time. And he is a pretty brutal, Vlad Dracula is a pretty brutal ruler to his own people. And this is the thing that gets discussed less. We talk about the impaling of all of these Ottoman soldiers as he's trying to like throw back this invasion from the Sultan. And I want to quote now from the wonderful book Children of the Night by Paul Kenyon, because this was a little piece of Dracula history that I hadn't heard. It was around this time, during the first couple of years of Dracula's rule, that he organized a notorious feast for all the beggars of Targoviste. The event appeared to be a great humanitarian gesture. The hall was hired and tables were filled with food and wine. Invitations were put out around the city to the cripples, the blind, the diseased, and the destitute. They all congregated in a large wooden hall, toasting Dracula's generosity. But towards the end of the meal, someone noticed smoke coming from the walls. They ran to the door, only to find Dracula's troops had locked it from the outside and set the place ablaze. Many hundreds were trapped, and a bonfire of souls was left burning into the dark Wallachian sky. The bonfire of the beggars, as it became known, was a warning. Begging would not be tolerated. It was a drain on the finances of the most decent and generous in society, said Dracula, a crime as evil as theft. Wallachians were uneasy. It was one thing killing the rich, but to massacre the poor in such violent circumstances? On the other hand, Dracula's tactics did seem to be working, and crime fell. It was said that Dracula's guards would test the townsfolk by leaving a purse full of gold coins in a busy marketplace. When the guards came to collect it in the evening, the purse was always left untouched. The admiration for authoritarian solutions would also resonate down the centuries. So that is kind of like,
that's going to be effective because, you know, of the murder.
Yeah, yeah. When you murder enough people, you can decrease the crime rate. That is, and this is a lesson that no Romanian leader is ever going to forget. And it kind of like Vlad is sort of setting the tone here for an awful lot of their history, right down to the fact that you've got this kind of peasant population that is getting mistreated by its leaders enough that many people are starving in the streets. And so the solution of the ruler is, well, what if we just light those people on fire?
This is like a Facebook comments section gone to life. Like this is what a lot of people from my hometown would like to do.
Oh, Matt Walsh is totally down for this. Yeah.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The Daily Wire is already writing a think piece on how Vlad Dracula had the right, how literal Dracula had the right idea on improving our civic spaces.
Yeah. The New York Times is going to post an editorial that says, are there too many poor people?
Yeah.
Question mark.
What if we just light them on fire, you know? And I think this is one of those areas where my moral sort of compass is at odds with the intellectual side of me. Because on a moral level, I think it's always okay to set fires. But clearly, sometimes fires can be bad. And this is something I'm still grappling with, Jeff.
Yeah, I mean, well, fires can have disastrous results, but fire itself is awesome. Like, I keep fire with me when I'm recording at all times. I have to have an open flame near me. Or else what's the point? What if wolves came in while I was recording?
You're not going to be able to keep the wolves away if you don't have a fire. Like, I'm in San Francisco right now as we record this, and I have a fire on me at all times because, famously, San Francisco is a city with a wonderful history of fires that I want to celebrate. You know, all of the good fires San Francisco.
It's called knowing your history.
That's right. That's right. So Romania in the years after Dracula, who gets murdered before he's very old. Again, none of these Romanian princes last all that long. So Romania spends most of the medieval period as a vassal of the Ottoman Empire. And this state of affairs lasts until pretty recently. The country does not get its independence until the Russo-Turkish War of 1877 to 1878. It becomes an independent kingdom with a Hohenzollern regent. So, you know, whenever they have these, because this happens a lot where you're having these chunks of Europe become independent from either their former masters or from the Ottomans or whatever. And they all need kings, right? Because it's still the attitude in the 1800s that every new country ought to have some sort of king. So there's this kind of like constant, it causes a lot of conflict. This is a lot of what sets up World War One. But Romania, because of how close it is to Germany, winds up with a Hohenzollern region. Which like theoretically should mean that they're going to side with the Germans on everything. That's actually not what happens in practice, but that's certainly what the Germans think when they make sure Romania gets this this guy who's related to the Kaiser. Now
yes, totally our friends, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also the mess that by the time World War One rolls around, like the country has this Hohenzollern king, but it also has a queen who's one of Queen Victoria's grandchildren, which is also super common, right? Everybody's got one of Victoria's kids or grandkids somewhere in their fucking royal family.
Yeah, they're collecting them. They're like Pokemon.
Yeah, exactly. And the Hohenzollerns have caught at least one. And she's actually kind of rad. They have this horrible war in like 1912, 1913, where Romania tries, because when Romania becomes independent, they don't have Transylvania, right? Transylvania is still property of the Hungarians. So at one point they invade Hungary right before World War One, and it goes just absolutely terribly. But Queen Mary, who's this Victoria's grandkid, winds up like working as a combat nurse in this frontline position, and it really, she becomes very beloved by the Romanian people, and she seems to be legitimately the only royal in Europe during this period of time who doesn't completely suck, because while the rest of them are starting a series of wars that will kill tens of millions, she's just sort of like working as a trauma nurse the entire time.
She's like trying to do good. It's funny
she she seems dope, actually.
The Hungarians, I don't know if you've ever covered this on the thing, but what do you know about like their nomenclature, right? Like the history of that name? That they were just the Magyars. They're the Magyars,
right?
Yeah, so they're Magyars. And then When people saw them, they were like, ah, they fight like the Huns. It's sort of like how we called Native Americans Indians. We were just like, God. Ah, you're Indian. It's just whole like, ah, you guys are Hungarians. You're like the Huns. And they're like, no, we are our own people.
That reminds me of like where the word barbarian came from, which is that the Greeks just thought everyone who wasn't Greek sounded like they were going bar, 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 bar all the time.
Yeah, it's very like, oh, durka, durka, durka. And then
Yeah. Racism before racism. It's that deep racism.
It's true, pure racism.
Yeah, it's absolutely pure, uncut by the later, the corruption that went into racism later.
Yeah, before racism got so commercial, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, just a bunch of guys looking at people who live over the hill near them and saying, sounds they all talk weird.
Yeah, yeah, they did it for the love of the game.
Yeah, yeah, it's the Honus Wagner of racism. That's the Europeans in this. Well, at least in ancient history.
Yeah.
So so you got Romania. They have this disastrous war where they try to take, and the reason why they lose the war, because it goes well for like a day, and then everybody gets sick from mosquitoes and starts dying. Which is not an uncommon story in the history of war.
Tale as old as time, really.
Yeah, yeah. But outside of that, when kind of World War One starts to break out, Romania is kind of in a decent position because they've got this king, their first king, Carol the First, who's in charge right up until 1914, and he drops kind of right before the war drums start sounding. And the king who follows, Ferdinand, is a pretty smart guy and is like, I don't think World War One's going to go well for anybody. I don't want to get involved in this shit. I just would like to, I can sell food and fuel because Romania's got a hell of a lot of oil. I'll just sell that shit to the Germans and we won't send all of our guys off to die, which is a good strategy and would have been a winner if they had stuck with it. But they are not going to stick with it. Now, part of the reason why the new king is kind of hesitant to get involved in World War One and doesn't want to like is because he doesn't want to risk upsetting the peasants. Romanian political history in this period up to pretty much the modern day, a huge amount of it is kind of based around the struggle between these urbanized populations, which are still a very small chunk of the country in the late 1800s, and the majority of the country, which is the peasantry. And the peasants, especially in the late in the early 1900s, late 1800s, they're not quite serfs, but they also are basically renting land from the whatever noble owns it and paying them kind of ruinous taxes in order to get to farm it. So it's kind of a worse situation than being a serf because they're actually like they're technically free, but they have to pay their boss, being, you know, whatever noble's in charge of the area, for the privilege of getting to work the land enough to produce enough food to not starve to death, which is a bad, like, one of the most common foods that Romanian peasants live on in this period of time is, like, cheese that's infested with maggots. That and, like, pickled vegetables is a lot of their diet. Maggots
cheese,
have protein.
That's, like, still... So. It's like illegal, but it's like a super delicacy from there, right? They still do that.
I don't know if it's from Rome. I know there's a cheese in Sicily that's all maggoty. Like, I think there's probably a few different versions of it. But back in the day, it is not a nice food, right? It's I think maybe now it's become a delicacy. But then it's like, well, we're not going to not eat this cheese just because it's filled with maggots, because otherwise we'll die. So
I just get a little speaking of maggots, out of it.
The products and services that support this podcast will add maggots to any order you make. Hit us up. The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play. My favorite spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity you get. wow, how have I been living like this? It's kind of like when you find out you've been paying a fortune for wireless, when Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. Wow, how have I been affording this? It's time to switch to Mint Mobile and get unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Say bye-bye to your overpriced wireless plans, jaw-dropping monthly bills, and unexpected overages. Mint Mobile is here to rescue you with premium wireless plans starting at $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all your existing contacts. To get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/behind. That's mintmobile.com/behind. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/behind. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this.
I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered. Could just be
in
me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
We're back, and I just had a hoagie made entirely out of maggots. Delicious. Yeah.
I had a maggot protein shake. It was nice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Maggot protein's the cleanest burning protein out there. You can't do better than maggots. That's the motto of this podcast.
Behind the Bastards, Sophie. You can't do better than maggots.
No, that's it. It's the true superfood. If you just, all you actually need in your diet, just a 50-50 mix of maggots and acai berries, and you'll never die.
Yeah, I looked up Casu Marzu just to see that's the cheese, and boy, that's...
Oh, is that the Romanian one? Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a pecorino from sheep's milk, yeah.
Yeah, it is not a delicacy at the time.
Yeah.
So one of the big reasons that that King Frederick doesn't want to go to war, doesn't want to get involved in World War I, is because he doesn't feel like he has a good handle on the peasantry kind of as they go into this period. And a big part of why is that there's an uprising in 1907, right, which is, you know, pretty recent still in 1914. And this uprising, this peasants uprising, starts because this guy named, I think it's basically pronounced John Dohescu, traveled to a protest outside of the mayor's house in a town called Flamazzi. And Dohescu and his fellow peasants, again, they're basically starving. This feudal system that governs their lives is super corrupt. And the way that it works is you've got these royals who own the land, and these royals basically hire a group of middlemen to manage it for them. And so the middlemen get their money off of skimming what they can off the top. And anything they're skimming is extra shit that the peasants are paying for, right? In addition to the pretty ruinously high taxes that the royals are imposing. Kenyon, in his book, notes that the peasantry in Romania is, quote, so comprehensively exploited that they were effectively paying their landlords for the privilege of working. So there's this protest outside of the mayor's house, and these peasants, including John Dohescu, wind up outside yelling at this estate manager, who's, again, kind of like this middle manager type guy. And he throws a rock at one of them, and it hits Dohescu in the eye. This, for whatever reason, starts shit. You know, sometimes
that's going to start shit. You ever been hit in the eye with a rock?
Yeah.
You're not going to throw a punch after that.
No, sure. But this also starts shit on a bigger scale. Like, everyone gets outraged on the behalf of this guy, which shit like this, it happens here, too. Like, you'll have the same kind of horrible violence being done by the same people every day. And then one day, suddenly thousands of people take to the streets. Right. And this is that version of that thing happening in Romania. So the peasants around Dohescu form a mob, and they start going through town and attacking all of the middlemen that these local aristocrats have been using to manage their land. And for a variety of reasons, most of these middlemen are Jewish, right? That's just who the aristocracy is like. Yeah, we'll have these guys. It's actually kind of a conscious decision by the aristocracy, because if you have this group of people managing your stuff and they're all Jewish, when the peasants get angry, you can just use racism to deflect from the fact that you're really the one responsible for their suffering. So that works very well in this case. And so the peasants' revolt that follows is both an act of protest against economic exploitation that is very justified and a vicious racist pogrom that is not justified.
You know what's funny is every time I do the show, that phrase, vicious racist pogrom, shows up. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm just like, oh, yeah, let's bring it on. Let's see who's doing terrible things to decent people. Well, Jeff,
to be fair, we keep bringing you on for episodes that are about Europe from like 1800 to 1950. So you're going to have to talk about pogroms.
It's going
to
happen.
There's nowhere that doesn't have them.
Yeah. A little playfully violent anti-Semitism mm-hmm. to get mm-hmm. us through the day every time. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff. So the peasants' revolt starts with these peasant mobs marching through towns, dragging Jews out of their homes, and then lighting the homes on fire. But as the revolt wears on, because it's 1907, 1905, Russia's just had an unsuccessful socialist revolution. And a lot of these revolutionaries who are kind of like on the run from the Tsar wind up heading over to Romania. And they start preaching to the masses that like, hey, guys, the Jews as a group are not responsible for your suffering. It's the property holding class who's exploiting you. And this actually has a positive impact. There's less pogroms kind of later in the peasants' uprising.
They
and
relaxed.
More just attacking rich people. So that's good.
Yeah, they relaxed a little bit.
Yeah. The whole thing comes to a head in April of 1907 when 6,000 peasants gather with axes to protest for redistribution of land. Right. And what they're protesting for is like, we want to own the land that we live on and work our entire lives rather than it being owned by some guy who can just like jack up the rent and starve us effectively. So the government of Romania is like, absolutely not, because the people who have control of the artillery are the people who own the land. So those people just have the military fire artillery directly into the crowd, killing 600 people in a matter of minutes.
Oh, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. It's pretty well, actually, by the end. I mean, the whole revolt, they kill about 11,000 people. So they kill. That's a good number of people killed. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. Repressive.
It's solid for a few minutes, if I'm being 100% honest. Like it takes Manhattan Project level shit to get numbers like that. So quickly.
Yeah. 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 This goes on for a few months, but like 11,000 people, it's pretty bloody. So King Ferdinand, who takes over 7 years after this, is like, we just tested the peasantry a little bit and we got closer to losing control than we want to admit. So I really don't want to like have to conscript a bunch of people and deal with the problems that that might cause.
Yeah, we dipped the toes in a little bit and found out that we get butchered. So,
yeah. And staying out of World War One absolutely would have been the right call for Romania. But here's the problem, Jeff. British people exist, and British people keep whispering in the Romanian king's ear, "Oi, governor, you want that Transylvania, do you?
We can get you that. What are you doing?
That's new
English.
That's
my English accent.
What the fuck Crikey. Are you doing?
I'm doing an English accent, Sophie.
He was You're like, not. Bruv. Bruv. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mate. Bruv. In yeah. it.
Jesus mm-hmm. Christ. Mm-hmm.
We got a war coming Luton. In it, bruv.
So that's what the British Empire is whispering into the ears of King Frederick. And, you know, basically the promise they're making him is, again, like, hey, you guys are like, Transylvania is majority Romanian population. It's controlled by Hungary. We agree that's unjust. If you come into the war on our side and like help us throw a wrench in the fucking German war effort, we'll make sure that you wind up with this greater Romania thing that all the nationalists in Romania are super gung-ho about when the war finally ends. And eventually this kind of thought of getting Transylvania back and all of these others, a couple of other provinces too, is too enticing for the king and sort of the nationalists in the Romanian government to not try to do. So in 1916, Romania enters World War One on the side of the Entente, and they attack the Central Powers. This briefly goes well for about 6 weeks. Romania takes back like a bunch of Transylvania. They take a couple of other areas from Hungary. They're like, they're having a real good time for like 6 weeks. But then the Germans show up. Now, the Imperial German Army is an army so competent that it took the entire world to beat them in this war. Like literally everyone else.
It's a good reminder that the German military, and obviously, you know, when you trace back to Otto von Bismarck and basically his description of creating a country based on the world's greatest army, like that was his whole thing.
Yeah.
That's going to be a big deal. Because they're just so good at war. That's been like their whole thing. They've been training for this.
And they are, the Germans at this point are, obviously, they are tied up 2 years into the war on the Western Front, which has killed more men more quickly than probably any other war in history prior to this point. They're also fighting all of Russia, which is a fifth of the planet's landmass, not that far from Romania. And then Romania enters. And so the Germans take like a tiny little chunk of their forces and they send it towards Romania, and they just curb stomp them.
It's like, fuck you?
Like, yeah. Within days, it becomes clear that, like, oh, they are going to occupy the entire country. Romania will no longer be in it. Like, they are coming for the capital. The royals start fleeing, right? They are fucking getting the hell out of town. And so the British decide... Well, first off, this didn't work. Clearly, Romania did not have what it took to take the Germans out of the fight.
Yeah, they're like, so we fucked around, and it turns out we found out.
They found out.
Yeah.
Which, you know, as the British Empire is always our preference, someone other than us find out. But now we have this problem. Romania has, like, basically the largest oil reserves in Europe, as certainly at this point, and Germany does not have any oil, right, on its own, pretty much. So... the Germans are about to gain access to these oil fields that would effectively allow them to gain an enormous material advantage in this war that is kind of a squeaker. So the Germans send over, or the British send over a guy, this lieutenant colonel named John Norton Griffiths, who sounds like a war crimes guy and is about to do him a war crime because he lights every oil field in Romania on fire. It's just like, set it all on fire. Fuck this shit. He does like a Saddam.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's like Iraq.
It like blots out the sun. It's obviously an ecological disaster, but it's a military success. He does stop the Germans from gaining access to Romania's fuel reserves, which, you know, is the smart play on a military. It's just awful. But that's war.
It's the salting the earth of natural resources. Yeah.
Yeah. So Romania does not do well in World War One. They get occupied by the Germans. But a couple of years later, the Germans eventually do lose the war. And when they lose the war, Romania actually kind of winds up in a really good position. And we're not going to get into like all of the wheeling and dealing that occurs. But, you know, a lot of folks feel like a lot of folks who side with the Central Powers kind of feel like they get fucked over. This is particularly an issue with the Italians, right? Where Italy's like, we did all this fucking dying fighting Austria, and we got basically nothing at the end of the war. Like, what the fuck is wrong with you people? Romania does really well. They get Transylvania. Like the British, to their credit, actually do give them what they had promised here. And so after World War One, Romania is like 30 or 40% larger and has a substantially larger population, a whole lot of resources and really productive land.
That's called buying low and selling high.
That's right.
They're like, we're not going to do much to help you win this war, but we will reap the benefits.
They bought the dip.
Yeah, right?
European civilization.
Yeah, Transylvania to the moon.
Yeah. So after World War One, Romania is in this really interesting position. They are subject to a lot of the same forces that are, you know, going wild in Russia. This is the height of the Russian Civil War. So the left has this huge surge in popularity. But Romania also has a pretty stable constitutional monarchy with this like parliamentary system, right? It's interesting that it works this way, but rather than kind of all of the energy on the left that is obviously like plays a huge role in what happens in Russia, rather than that leading to the establishment of a super radical left-wing political party in Romania that wants to get rid of the monarchy, change the nature of the state entirely, institute a socialist state, they get a left-wing political party called the National Peasants Party, which is very large. I think it wins like 78% of the vote in its most successful election.
Jesus.
And is advocating for like a lot. Well, it's because they're saying like, we want land reform, right? This thing that they had just had an uprising about. But they don't ever get like an organized, large communist movement. And in fact, for most of the 20s and 30s, there's maybe 1,000 like organized communists in all of Romania, which is not a ton. Like there's several million people in the country. So it's a very small population. Now, the organized far right is a lot larger than the communist left. Obviously, it's still a smaller chunk of the country because Romanian people tend to vote sort of progressive left in this period. But the organized far right in Romania is very aggressive and very organized, and they start carrying out a lot of violent fascist marches and particularly attacks against the Jewish population of towns and cities. And this becomes more and more common in the 20s and 30s. This is the country and the political situation that our hero for this week, Nicolae Ceaușescu, is born into on January 23rd, 1918. So he like comes into being right as this, you know, post-World War I Romania starts to be a thing. His father, whose name is Andruta, owned a small farm in a village called Scornișesti. And I'm going to try on the names here. I listen to pronunciations. I'm not going to get all of these right, guys. I'm sorry. There's a lot of Romanian names, and Scornișesti is probably close enough. His dad raised sheep and worked part time as a tailor. The family was about as poor as it is possible to be, and any money that did come into them went swiftly to Andruta's drinking habit. So he is a religious extremist and an alcoholic. Mysterious reasons, Nicolae Ceaușescu is going to decide he does not want to live around this guy for much longer. Very shocking. So there's this journalist, a Romanian journalist, Catalin Gruia, who interviewed people in Ceaușescu's hometown after his demise. Here's what he writes about Andruta. "He didn't take care of his kids. He stole. He drank. He was quick to fight, and he swore," said the old priest from Scornișesti. "His mother was a submissive, hardworking woman. The family slept on benches along the walls of a two-room house. Corn mush was their staple food. Nicolae went to the village school for years. The teacher taught simultaneous classes for different years in a one-room schoolhouse. The young Ceaușescu did not have books, and he often went to school barefoot. An outsider from early on, he did not have friends. He was anxious and unpredictable."
You brought a lot of Boston energy to the beginning there.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
He was just like, his father was a drinker. He was quick to fight all the time.
Always down at the Chowder House.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. Very good.
Mm-hmm. Getting into fights at the Duncan. And Ceaușescu, he doesn't ever fit in, right? He certainly doesn't fit in this small rural village. He's an anxious kid. He's got a stutter. He seems to be pretty smart. Surviving records indicate he did well in primary school. He had like the third highest grade in his class, but education was never going to be like a focus on his early life. And in 1929 at age 11, he leaves home. He just is like, fuck living with an abusive religious fundamentalist. I'm going to go to Bucharest and live with my sister. So he moves in with her and he, yeah, at 11,
I didn't do shit.
Life was
when I was
hard
11.
Back then.
Yeah. 11 is like a hard 28 nowadays.
Yeah. 11 is like 28 from like the grizzledest guy that you knew in your 20s.
Right.
Like,
yeah. He's tough as nails. This guy's like, I lift for ultimate fighting.
It's yeah. Like, he has as many stories of woe as like a 75-year-old Irish farmer by this point.
Like, it's like when you see those like pictures of like 25-year-olds coming back from war. Mm-hmm. You're just like, oh, no.
Yeah. So he gets to Bucharest. He moves in with his sister. He's working as a shoemaker. And this is what first brings him into contact with Romania's fairly small communist movement, because the guy he apprenticed for was a member of the Romanian Communist Party. And he takes Nicolae under his wing. This is an act of pure happenstance. Again, the National Peasants Party is pretty left-wing and a lot more popular. So there's just not a whole lot of people who do fall in with the communists in this period. And the fact that Nicolae wound up under the influence of one of the fairly few active communists in Bucharest is a wild stroke of fate that would prove pretty bad for everyone involved, including the communists. At first, though, Ceaușescu just did odd jobs for his boss. The Romanian Communist Party had been made illegal by the king, because royals don't tend to like communists, and vice versa. So even basic things like sending letters and distributing newspapers had to be done underground. It was illegal to advocate for the Communist Party. So Nikolai is kind of a low-level errand boy, helping them do this, helping them keep up communication between different cells, helping them distribute newsletters and all that stuff in this communist underground that's kind of growing up in Bucharest. He did not occupy a privileged position, and to his credit, he seems to be the kind of kid who had no problem throwing down in the street for his beliefs. He is not like taking the easy jobs, right?
He's not a Twitter pundit here.
No, he is not a Twitter pundit. One thing you have to give the kid is that he is putting his skin in the game. His first arrest is at age 15 when he gets picked up in this massive street fight outside of a strike. Basically, he's like siding with a bunch of striking workers and the police show up and he winds up brawling in the street with the fucking cops and such.
Hell yeah. Next year, if somebody's ever like, they were caught brawling in the street with the cops, you're like, all right, point.
At this point, he's a 15-year-old boy who's been arrested for throwing hands in order to defend striking workers.
Tossing cops.
Yeah. The next year, he gets busted for circulating a petition protesting the treatment of rail workers who had unionized illegally, right? So the state is punishing these workers because they're not allowed to unionize and they try to. And he circulates a petition being like, that's fucked up, and he goes to jail again. Some historians, there's a debate here between at least the people that I've encountered as to whether or not is Ceaușescu a committed, ideologically committed communist, or is this kind of just something he falls into and winds up committing to because of other reasons? Kitalin Gria puts it this way. The switch from a world in which he couldn't find his place, his own village, to another in which he still couldn't find his place, the intimidating city, marked him. His initiation into the marginalized movement of the communists was his alternative solution for integrating into social life, says sociologist Pavel Campaniu, author of the book Ceaușescu, The Countdown. So that's one angle that Campaniu and it certainly seems Gruia are pushing, which is that like he doesn't really fit in anywhere. And the communist movement, even though it is a very fringe and dangerous to be involved with, it offers him like this sense of belonging that he hasn't found anywhere else. So this is kind of his way of having a social life. There's a different argument, and Paul Kenyon makes it in his book, that is also kind of adjacent to that one. It's interesting. Quote, contemporaries said he had little genuine interest in politics and might easily have chosen the green shirts of Cadrianu's Iron Guard, which is like the fascist movement. But Nikolai Ceaușescu wanted to meet girls, and some of his friends had told him the prettiest were in the Communist Party. So I don't know. Maybe both of those things are true, that he falls in with the communists because it's the kind of the only place he fits in socially. And also part of why he thinks he'll fit in socially there is someone tells him the prettiest girls are communists.
It seems like he might be just going with the flow, that his ideologies are not ironclad, that he's just like, is there pussy over there? All right, well, I'm going to go to there.
I think that seems realistic, that like he's looking for friends and he's looking to hit on chicks, and the communists offer him that opportunity. And also over time, as he like fights with them in the street and does time, he just kind of gets more committed, because when you do prison time for a cause, maybe you wind up reading about it, I think is kind of the way his story goes.
Also, you don't want to double down. If you've done you've damaged yourself because of your commitment to a belief, it's so much harder to reject that belief than it is to be like, let me tell you why I was right. I still defend my choice to get a Sega Genesis over a Super Nintendo, even though I know I was wrong.
Well, and as I always say, being a Sega Genesis kid in the 90s is the being a communist underground activist of 1920s Romania, you know, same, essentially identical experiences, right down to the fact that Jeff, you in the 1970s wound up in charge of a small Eastern European nation that you then led into tremendous calamity.
How did I do it? You know, things just happen.
You should, at least you didn't get a Dreamcast. Then we'd be dealing with a death toll in the millions.
Oh, let me tell you. Yeah. I had a friend. You could just bootleg games on Dreamcast.
What a time that was.
You could just burn games.
Kids these days, you Gen Zers don't know, with your Steams and your whatever Nintendos you got now. We used to have real variety in gaming. There was that game with the dolphin. There was
Echo the Dolphin,
taxi game that was kind of like Grand Theft Auto.
Crazy.
There was
taxi.
That Simpsons game that was a ripoff of that taxi game. Oh, it Simpsons was a glorious age.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. What yeah. a time to be alive.
That so, was, I worked at a video game. I worked at the Toys R Us video game section then. So I'm like, oh, I can name all of these things.
So Nicolae Ceaușescu is, you know, he's the Sega Dreamcast owner of the Romanian political spectrum, I guess. By which I mean, he was very, very vocal about his beliefs and very committed at a certain point, at least, to them. But he was also not the most competent activist. And a number of his fellow communists would later argue that, like, the fact that he kept getting arrested for the cause was not evidence that he was, like, a very good at what he was doing. More just that, like, he had, like, a short fuse and would get into fights and he kept getting arrested. And he was bad at hiding from the cops and not getting scooped up.
Everyone's like, let's put him in charge of everything.
Yeah, yeah.
This guy fist fighting everybody in the streets.
One of the fun things about Ceaușescu is no one ever says that, and he winds up in charge anyway.
He's, you know, it's very Andrew Jackson energy.
Yeah. Yes, he is. He'll have one or two things in common with Jackson. Although I guess his big wheel of cheese would have been filled with maggots. Although I think Jackson's big wheel of cheese was probably filled with maggots, too. So regardless, the fact that he keeps doing time and he keeps getting the fuck beaten out of him by the cops and tortured and all that stuff, obviously this earns him respect, even from the people who are like, Jesus, dude, like, try running, you know, like, try not getting arrested escaping every time you go out into the street.
See, that's a New England thing, too, where it's like, yeah, I know I'm going to die, but I'm going to fight you in this public restroom.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what are you doing? Like,
yeah, the entire world is his Waffle House in South Carolina. And yeah, he gets busted repeatedly. His biggest prison sentence so far comes when he gets sentenced to 2 years in 1938. And by that time, he is a pretty notable figure in the Romanian Communist Party, even though he's not universally respected. Now, 1938 is an important year in Romanian politics. After the death of King Ferdinand, his young son Michael was technically regent, but a council of guys governed in his stead. They were sympathetic to the main conservative party in Romania. And when the National Peasants Party wins a resounding victory in the 28 elections, the head of the National Peasants Party decides to try and reduce his enemy's power by bringing in a new king, right? So you've got this child king who has, like, this guy basically governing for him as regent, and that guy is sympathetic to the conservatives. So when this kind of liberal left party takes power, they decide, well, if we bring in a new king who wants to work with us, then we can sideline this guy, and that'll be good for the Peasants' Party. Unfortunately, the new king they pick is Prince Carol II. Now, Carol II, up to this point, has been, like, a playboy royal. He spent, actually, a lot of his life outside Romania because he falls in love with this chick, but he's not allowed to marry her because she's not royal enough. So he's like, fuck you, mom and dad.
Do the Justinian move, man.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to go live somewhere else with this broad. And he had been, as far as I can tell, kind of apolitical most of his life. Again, he's mostly interested in, like, fucking and partying. And was probably most famous when at the outbreak of World War I, he's in a military unit like a lot of royals are, and he immediately deserts. He's just like, absolutely not.
Hell yeah, man.
I am not doing a World War I. So again, unproblematic so far. But once he gets brought in as king, he immediately proves to be problematic, actually. So Carol II effectively derails the progressive land justice-oriented policies of the National Peasants Party while playing the conservative and the growing far-right parties off of each other. And this is a pretty impressive balancing act at the time, that he's able to kind of, like, weaponize all these groups against each other to solidify his own power. Throughout this period, the Great Depression hits, and Romania is obviously suffering at least as much as everywhere else is. And the fact that Carol II is kind of derailing the Peasants' Party's ability to push for real reform leaves a lot of voters to abandon them and abandon kind of the progressive left and start siding with these weird domestic fascists that have started to become very popular in Romania, called the Iron Guard.
That could never happen here.
No. It only happens in Romania this one time. So the Iron Guard are also called the Legionaries or the Legionary Movement. Again, like, Romania, there's a big hard-on, especially in kind of, like, the nationalist side of things for Roman history. So they are kind of consciously, like, talking back to their Roman heritage and calling these guys the Legionary Movement. The Iron Guard are founded by a fascist death squad member and a medieval mystic named Cornelio Codriano. And Codriano, we'll do an episode on him at some point. He's a fascinating fascist and one that we don't talk about enough.
He's fascinating.
He is fascinating. He is kind of a mix between like, there's an element of him that's like the Gavin McGinnis Proud Boy type where he forms this street fighting organization, but he also like, he becomes famous because he assassinates a dude. Like one of the things he tells his young followers is you need to be forming death squads and murdering people. And it's okay if we get executed. Like that's actually dope. If we get killed for assassinating leftists, like that's a thing that we should seek to do. So he definitely sucks. Another one of his beliefs is that he needs to father thousands of children with women at all levels of Romanian society because the saint that he liked, he believes did that too. So
that's a good way to find a saint, man.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Which saint is all about straight fucking?
This horny fascist fucking mystic who, yeah, dresses like a medieval, like basically dresses in Ren Faire gear, marching from town to town and inciting pogroms, right? That's Codrianu's like primary method of
it's like pushing. He's on tour. Like he's on an anti-Semitic tour.
Yeah. Now, obviously, Hitler loves this guy. Hitler is a big Codrianu fan. And as his movement gains power, the Nazis start shipping guns over to the Iron Guard, right? Kind of like underground. Here, have some guns. We'll be over there pretty soon, guys. So get ready. King Carol II, he finds the Iron Guard useful in some ways, and he's, you know, perfectly willing to overlook a few pogroms, even though his mistress is Jewish, because he's like, hey, you know, whatever helps me stop these peasant people from reducing the power of the royals.
Wait, yeah. Political anti-Semites were selective in their choice of enforcement? That's unheard
Shocking.
Of.
Shocking. Another thing that only occurred once in Romania. So King Carol II generally considers the fascists useful, whereas the socialists and the Peasants' Party people, they want to reduce his power. So he sides with them a lot throughout the 20s. And early 30s. But then in like 1937, the Iron Guard starts to win larger and larger shares of the vote. I think they top out at like 22% of the vote in the 37 election. And he's like, oh shit, well, I can't really control these guys necessarily, right? Like it was a good bet to back them earlier, but now Codrianu's like getting within spitting distance of real power and he doesn't owe me anything, right? Like he's not, I can't actually trust this guy. He could fuck me up even worse than these Peasants' Party people would. So Carol II starts to panic.
It's so hard for me not to hear you go party people whenever you say yeah. Party people, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, most of these parties would have sucked ass. I mean, I assume the National Peasants Party parties would have been okay. Yeah,
not a lot of whoop there it is happening at these parties.
Apparently, hey, all the hot people are at the Communist Party, so that sounds like it could be good. Although you might wind up fucking Nicolae Ceaușescu, which is a mixed bag. Although Sophie says he's hot, so you know.
Sophie is down.
Only mm-hmm. one photo, okay. I take it back. Only one photo. Okay.
Oh, he was just one of those guys that got caught at a good angle so he's hot forever in history books.
It looked almost like a mugshot. I don't know if it actually is or not, but there was like one photo and then you like look at the rest and you're like, oh no.
It's like everyone sharing the hot Stalin photo.
Yeah, which is not accurate. Shockingly, you can't rely on on pictures of Joseph Stalin to know how he actually looked.
But you know what you can rely on, Robert?
Us and no one else?
The products and services that support the show.
Well, sure. I just don't separate between us and the products and services that support our show. You know, we're one beautiful amalgam that you should just dive into and let it subsume you. Swim in us.
I mean, stop.
Just absorb it in here. You know what? Yeah. I love goods and services that are provided by the sponsors of this podcast. As a matter of fact, it should be known that I am a subscriber / purchaser / user of all of these things.
Yeah, Jeff's buying gold. He's joined the Washington State Highway Patrol. He's doing all of the things our sponsors urge us to do. He's engaging in sports betting.
Yep. I'm doing all those things. Just really doing them.
The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table. Countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams. Constantly changing challenges like money sprees or treasure hunts that keep it fresh with new wild mini-games. Timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums, delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches, unique playing pieces, and so much more. The verdict is in with Monopoly Go. There's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now for free on the App Store and Google Play.
Me. Focus Features presents Back to Black.
I want people to hear my voice and just forget their troubles.
Experience the music and her story.
Know this, I ain't no Spice Girl.
Like never before.
That's my daughter, that's my Amy.
On the big screen.
I want to be remembered for just being me.
Amy Winehouse, Back to Black, directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. Rated R, under 17, not a minute without parent. Only in theaters May 17th.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And we're back. So, in the 1937 elections, the Iron Guard win like 20% of the vote. And the Peasants' Party has like a collapse of their power. You know, they'd gotten something north of like 70% a few years ago. And they get 32% of the vote in that election, which is short of the... I mean, that means that they do technically the best, but they need 40% of the vote to form a government, right? So since they don't meet that threshold, the king's going to get to help form the government, and that's not going to end well. And I'm going to quote from the book Children of the Night here. And now it was for the king to decide who would become prime minister. He knew the public wanted a change and began looking down the table of results. In fourth place, behind Codriano's legionaries, was the moderately fascist National Christian Party, led by Octavian Goga. The anti-Semitic poet was a great friend and supporter of the king, and Codriano's most bitter rival. He had scored just 9% of the vote. As far as Carroll was concerned, he was perfect for the job.
Anti-Semitic poet is the most fascinating combination of two words in history.
Yeah, just a racist pope, but a moderate fascist.
Yeah,
that'd
be
nice.
Like Nazi ballerina. Like there's certain words that you don't necessarily conflate the two things together.
Yeah, and you don't hear a lot of moderate fascists these days. But I guess it is. I mean, it is actually a thing in this period. Like it's reasonable to draw a line between the two of them because the Iron Guard and the National Christian Party are pretty bitter rivals and spend a lot of time fighting each other.
I would add that we have that here with the quote Law and Order. The people that really they're like, well, you know, I don't believe in all of these things, but, you know, we should make sure that anybody that commits a crime is shot in the face.
Yeah. It's those weirdos who are like, I think we should execute people for spraying graffiti during protests, but also fuck the January 6th folks, where it's like, yeah, you're a moderate fascist.
Yeah. Just a diet fascist, a little.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's who this moderate fascist poet, anti-Semite Goga, gets made prime minister by the king. And within 2 days of his appointment, he has shut down both of the large Jewish-owned newspapers in Romania. He has the Bucharest Bar suspend the licenses of every Jewish lawyer that they can find. He rescinds the right to sell liquor and tobacco by Jewish shopkeepers. And he withdraws citizenship from all 225,000 naturalized Romanian Jews.
Now, so, I'm going to go out on a limb here. Uh-huh. Not cool. Sorry if I'm courting controversy here, but that is an uncool move. Kind of a dick move, some would say.
And this podcast is brought to you by the letter P for pogroms, because that's what comes next, is there's a bunch of pogroms.
Are they a sponsor? Because I don't support that that specific one. I do not consume that.
Yeah, that. I mean, we never know who's going to sponsor the show in the programmatic ads, so it's not impossible. But we do have a hard no pogrom line in our ad sheet. Yeah.
And now back to our regularly scheduled program.
Yeah. So there's a bunch of pogroms. There's also fighting in the streets between Kotlianu's green shirts and between these moderate fascists, right? Because the green shirts are angry that they don't get the full fascism. They get some pogroms, but not all of the pogroms that they had wanted.
The idea of a moderate anything getting into a fist fight is just very ironic.
Yeah. I want racism. I want slightly less racism. Yeah.
And then I want a little less racism, but still some racism.
So this is all basically a con by King Carol. Like, he knows that, well, if I put, you know, this fucking Goga guy in power, he's going to do a bunch of horrible shit. And also the legionaries are going to try to do them an uprising, and it's going to be this big gnarly mess. And it is this big gnarly mess. And he uses that to be like, hey, guys, parliamentary democracy just can't work for some reason. So you know what? We're putting an end to that. I'm suspending the Constitution, and now I'm the dictator king. So he does that in the 10th of February, 1938. He becomes the dictator king of Romania. So that's cool. Good for him. And he's not going to be good at this, right? Carol II is kind of shitty at everything. The good thing that he does, I will give him credit for one thing, which is that he has Codrianu murdered. They arrest him and a bunch of his supporters and just execute them at a black site, basically. And that's okay. I'm not against that. But he mainly executes Codrianu because he's creating his own fascist movement that is very deliberately ripping off the legionaries. He basically like does the fucking Kirkland brand Iron Guard movement. Classic. And in fact, like Hitler and the Nazis will like make fun of him for being a fake fascist. They're like, look at this guy. He's not even like a real fascist. He's just copying this dude he murdered.
It's like when Transformers came out and sci-fi had Transmorph.
Yeah, he is the Transmorphers of Romanian fascism. He also steals a huge percentage of the national budget to siphon into his private bank account for when he inevitably gets forced out of the country and has to abdicate.
We couldn't have this
happening soon. Yeah,
we would not have this happening anytime soon in America.
No, of course not. Of course not, because we don't call them kings, so it's fine.
Yeah, so it's not the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah, so he's not a very successful royal dictator. He is not going to last long. And while he is kind of trying to solidify his hold on power, the USSR and Nazi Germany are deciding that, you know, why can't we be friends? Which is what that song is about, actually. It's about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. So the USSR and the Nazis have them a pact, and they're like, What if we met in Poland and kissed at the line we draw and enforce with an unbelievable quantity of human blood?
To be fair, by the way, that song is by the band War.
Mm-hmm.
So it really does fit.
It does. It's actually kind of perfect. The USSR and Nazi Germany are like briefly BFFs in taking Poland. And the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, a lot of people don't know this, but it contains some secret provisions. And one of those secret provisions is the Nazi saying, Stalin, you can take Bessarabia from Romania, which is Bessarabia is like one of the wealthiest parts of Romania. It's like literally a third of like the population and the economy of Romania is in Bessarabia. So when the Soviets move in and take it, Romania's like, Hitler, come on, guy. We're kind of fascist. What, you want to have our back? And Hitler's like, no, man, you killed my boy Codrianu. Fuck you guys. So this doesn't work great for anybody. It certainly does not increase Carol II's popularity back home. So that's going to be one of the reasons why he doesn't last very long. And while all this is going on, right, in the late 30s, you've got this fascist movement becoming ascendant. You've got increasing crackdowns on the communists. There's maybe 700 of them, many of whom are not free in the country at this point in time. But Ceausescu, you know, manages to stay alive. He, in part because the fascists are not, obviously, like the Romanian fascists, like all fascists, have a lot of anti-communist rhetoric. But the communists are not the Iron Guard's focus, because there's just not that many of them, right? It's not like they actually have bigger threats from the state. And so that's who they focus on. And so, you know, while Ceausescu is continuing his string of getting arrested for a bunch of bullshit, he doesn't, you know, get murdered by the Nazis. And he doesn't, I don't think, spends a particularly large amount of time fighting with them in the street. What he does do is spend a lot of time hitting on the women of the Romanian Communist Party. This is how, in 1939, he meets his future wife, Elena Petrescu. She had grown up in a tiny rural village like Nicolae and become a communist after moving to the city. Elena did not do well in school. Unlike Nicolae, she does not appear to be a good book learner. She failed basically every class. But in the 1930s, she gets a job at a black market pill mill and decides that this means that she's a chemist. So her lifelong ambition is going to be to become a chemist, because she works at a pill mill that's basically reverse engineering diet pills and then pressing them.
I mean, look, which is kind honestly, of funny. If you work in a place that's going to war a lot, having what is essentially speed on demand, that's great. Give me some of that bootleg
not
ephedrine
a
or
bad
whatever.
Idea. So in the summer of 1939, the Romanian Communist Party holds a picnic and a small fair that like includes a fundraising competition. And the way they do this competition is that like all of the girls get together and they give each of them a number. And the girl who is able to basically sell the most tickets to raise funds at this party is named Queen of the Ball. Now, Elena is not a charismatic person. She is not good at talking to people. She does not like crowds. She is not social. She is not someone who is going to be very good at selling tickets on her own. But Nicolae seems to pretty much falls in love with her at first sight. He has just gotten out of prison for distributing communist propaganda at this point. And he is like, she obviously likes him too, because he's this like hard son of a bitch who's just gotten out of prison. He's like a fighter for the party. And so they make eyes, and kind of as his first gesture to win her favor, he threatens to beat up all of his friends if they don't buy tickets from Elena in order to so that she can win Queen of the Ball. Which is both will show, because in the future he is going to do like the nationwide version of this, like sending out squads to beat the shit out of people who don't vote for the Communist Party.
She looks like the kid from Dick Tracy.
Yeah.
Like she looks.
She certainly does. As,
like the nerd from Can't Hardly Wait. If you remember, like she looks exactly like that dude.
Yeah, she is. That's a good way of looking at her. And
she's a handsome woman.
Nicolae Ceausescu looks like a Muppet version of a communist. Like he's got that big head that you could, if you look at a picture of adult Ceausescu, you can't imagine him talking normally. You can only imagine the entire
like
top
Eagle.
Of his head flapping backwards.
Yeah. He looks like Sam Eagle.
Yeah, he does. Yes, he has strong Sam Eagle characteristics. So, this is, I don't know, it's kind of sweet. There's a darker tone to it because he's going to like violently fake an election later in his life. But it's kind of sweet now that he's doing that to, you know, make this girl he likes feel pretty. So that's kind of nice.
Look, not for nothing, but seeing her win a beauty contest, I'd be like, all right, well, this is clearly a fix, right?
Well, yeah.
Apologies to her family.
No. I mean, her family is terrible. That goes great for him, and the two of them hook up and they get married, and he's going to spend a lot more time in prison, but they seem to have legitimately been a love match. Now, normally that's sweeter than it turns out to be, because they are both some of the worst people who have ever lived, but I'll give them one thing. They seem to have been legitimately in love. So
monsters can be in love. That's a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. In 1940, Carol II's dictatorship collapses with some help from the Nazis. And the new cat in town is a military man named Marshal Antonescu, who basically runs a military dictatorship with fascist trappings. He uses the Iron Guard. He like puts them adjacent to power. But Antonescu, he's a monster, but he's not ideologically a fascist. Like, you can, like, again, this is where we get into the terms, because he, like, is a major player in the Holocaust. He's a terrible, terrible person. I'm not saying that to be like, he's not as bad as these fascists. He is a military dictator. He is not a fascist dictator, and he doesn't really like the Iron Guard all that much. He's willing to use them because he's a strong nationalist. but he considers them way too radical to actually run things. And while all this is going on, all of Romania's communists are either in prison or hiding out in the USSR. And again, there's maybe 600 or 700 of them in the country still. The leaders of the movement in Romania are Anna Pocker, a Jewish woman and a veteran revolutionary Stalinist, and Georgi Georgiou Day. He's an electrician who became an illegal train union organizer and spends some of Ceausescu's first arrests are like supporting his Georgiou Day's illegal train strikes. And he's also a Stalinist. Everybody's a Stalinist, right? So Georgi was a poor peasant with what Marxists considered unimpeachable proletarian pedigrees. He's basically like the archetype of the kind of guy Stalin pushed as the ideal new Soviet man. He's this like born poor, working his entire life, organizing unions and fighting in the streets to support the rights of workers to organize. Pocker, meanwhile, she's also does a lot of time for the cause. She is a tough lady. In fact, she gets the nickname the Iron Lady of Romania. But she's also an intellectual, right? She's one of these people who comes to communism like through reading about it and is a like as opposed to like Georgiou Day does not read books, right? Does not talk a lot about reading. He's not citing a whole lot of like passages from Marxist tracts, which Pocker is. She is fiercely devoted to the cause, but the fact that she's also on kind of this creative ideological side of things means that she's going to run into conflict during the messy early years of the USSR. And for a little while, Pocker is in Stalin's good books. She flees to the USSR for a period. She goes to this Soviet school for revolutionaries where she studies tactics to help her build the covert communist movement in Romania. But she also encounters a lot of difficulties because, number one, she's Jewish. And number two, she's a woman. And so those things are
not good at the time.
Not great at the time.
Now it's perfect for all of those people, especially in America.
Yeah, yeah. Everything's fine now. But back in the day, difficult. And she also runs into problems because she runs afoul of Stalin and she gets executed and her husband gets executed for being a Romanian spy, right? I don't believe he is. I've never seen any evidence that Pocker's husband was spying for anyone. He seems to have been a really committed communist, but he gets executed over in the USSR. And Anna finds out about it while she's 4 years into a 10-year prison sentence in Romania. She had formed a group of prisoners called the Women's Collective of Anti-Fascist Prisoners. And when the news reaches them that Anna's husband has been executed, she doesn't even get time to mourn him before the other women demand that she explain why she'd married a traitor. A criticism session is held in prison in which Anna is blamed for not warning the party that her husband was an agent provocateur. And eventually Anna tells them, "I am now racking my brain to find something, a sign of any kind that would have led me to believe he was an enemy of the people. I'm not placing any doubt on the party's decision. The party knows better than I, but I did not see anything. And as much as I search my soul, my recollections, my memory, I don't find anything that could prove such a thing," which is like almost certainly true and kind of a devastating thing to imagine this woman who's stuck in prison, who's just found out the love of her life has been killed by the state and is now like, well, the party must have been right in killing him, but I just didn't see a sign of it. It's super fucked up. And
yeah,
the rest
I guess that's
of this,
the best way to handle that is to just be like, well, look, I'm sure the people that are still alive with the guns, they had great reason to do that. I'm just saying I personally didn't see it, but they probably nailed that shit. Maybe he was tricking me.
It doesn't go well for her because she does not like repudiate him fully. Yeah. And so these ladies that she's formed into a group in prison, like send back word to Stalin saying, Anna won't denounce her dead husband. And this winds up being one of the justifications Stalin would later use for backing Georgi over Anna.
It would be funny if it was like a real suppressed. True lies scenario where he was like this huge jacked, like Austrian sounding guy. It's like, I sell computers.
I am a communist. Yeah. No, it doesn't work out that way, unfortunately. Georgi Georgiou Day also spends his war years locked away in a fascist prison. Because the Antonescu regime is not quite as Nazi as the straight-up Nazis wanted it to be, communists in concentration camps there did have a higher rate of survival than they did in, like, Germany. So what actually happens is once all these people get thrown into these prisons, they kind of settle out what the communist government of the future Romania is going to be in these prison cells, which is a thing that happens every time you throw a bunch of radical revolutionaries into prison cells together, is they wind up sorting out the future regime that they're going to bring into power at a certain point.
Yeah, I mean, they got time.
Yeah, exactly. They've got time to, like, read books about communism and figure out who's going to do what when they eventually wind up in power.
Ooh, when our number comes up, we're going to have to go ahead and make a perfect communist government.
Yep, and that's exactly what's going to happen. So George Uday is obviously, I think everyone kind of is aware, just because he's such a powerful person, that he's going to wind up being, like, the top man if they ever do wind up in power. And Ceausescu sees this, and he is, again, he gets thrown into prison again during the World War II years for conspiring against the social order. And he kind of turns himself into a gopher for George Uday. He makes himself available for, like, whatever sort of side jobs they need done. He does everything that'll keep it, like, he doesn't care what he has to do, no matter how, like, banal or low the task is, as long as it's going to keep him on the lips of his betters, right? I just want to stay around George Uday, you know, as long as he keeps seeing me and knows me as, like, this guy who can handle anything he wants, like, that's what I'm going to do.
He's just jazzed to be on the show, man.
Yeah, just happy to be here, man. Just happy to be here. And this strategy worked splendidly, as Paul Kenyon writes. They had a lackey in prison, a young hooligan who brought them food packages and ran messages. His name was Nicolae Ceausescu, a 22-year-old trainee cobbler who was regularly in trouble for fighting and delivering communist leaflets. Some of his fellow inmates thought him weird and said that they avoided him because he was such a bore with absolutely no sense of humor. In the presence of big men like George Uday, Ceausescu remained largely silent and deferential. He avoided speaking whenever possible because of a stutter so severe it made his legs shake, but he also possessed a powerful memory and an instinctive intelligence, and sat among the future leaders listening to everything they said and slowly learning. And this actually works out well for him, because since he's too kind of scared and nervous to speak up or say anything, he never winds up running afoul of George Uday, right? He puts himself in positions to help with stuff, but he's never running anything that can, like, go badly and reflect poorly on him. And he pays attention to the social relationships and kind of worms his way closer and closer to George Uday over time, Stalin does a version of this. That's how he rises to power, too. This is a pretty effective tactic. So if you are ever in a revolutionary underground movement that's seeking to overthrow the state and institute a new form of government, keep an eye out for, like, the weird quiet kid who just hangs around doing chores. Shoot that guy pretty quick.
Okay, that's something that advice. I do need to have in my to have that written down.
Yeah,
Keep that in my back pocket.
Drop that kid before he gets too far. That's where all the problems start.
Yeah, gotta get all my moves ready, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Legally, and Robert does not mean that literally.
I do mean
he
that
does.
Literally.
Yeah, he does.
Before Robert, you overthrow the government, kill the quiet kid in your movement. Just drop them all.
Yeah. Take a page out of
Dracula's book. Burn them in a thing. Put them all in a building and light it on fire. Only let the loud assholes inherit power, because that will never go badly.
No, we just mostly get podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's going to do it for our part one of Ceausescu. And boy, howdy, have you had a good time here, Jeffrey?
All I could ask for.
Jefftoberfest.
That's me. That's who I am. I'm glad that you got my name correct.
That's right. That's right. That's you and the festival dedicated to celebrating your many accomplishments every October.
I got to say, I love being here. Love spending time with you guys. It's a real blast. I love relearning. Sometimes I'm like, that degree I got wasn't worth anything. And then I do this show every once in a while and I'm like, that's good enough.
Jeff, you got to plug anything here before we roll out?
Are people still listening at this point in time when we do plugs? Let's do it, man. Depending on when this goes up, I run a stand-up show, a live stand-up show at a toy store in Burbank, California, called Mint on Card at a store called Blast from the Past on Magnolia in Burbank, California. You can check that out the second Friday of every month. I have a great podcast called Jeff Has Cool Friends, where I interview my friends that I think have really cool jobs, and I think you should pay attention to them. You can get that for free, or you can get early access to uncensored episodes with bonus content at patreon.com/JeffMay. It's just my name. I also have shows like Ugh Fine with Kim Kroll. Isn't that easy? It's so easy. Ugh Fine, my monthly show with Kim Kroll. And I also have a great show called Nerd with Dre Alvarez that we do on the Patreon and for free. And that is, we just do deep dives on nerdy shit. I also do Tom and Jeff Watch Batman on the Gamefully Unemployed Network, which we keep needing to bring you on to. I know you like you want to do Batman stuff.
I do want to do Batman stuff, by which we'll mean I want to beat up poor people in the street while wearing $10,000 in body armor.
In armor, of course. Yeah. As an Olympic level athlete, yes.
Yeah, martial artist beating the shit out of a heroin addict in an alley.
Perfect. Just breaking someone's back for stealing a Magnavox. You can also hear me on Unpopular Opinion and You Don't Even Like Sports, both on the Unpops Network. Other than that, thank you. This is fun. We have fun here.
Yes. I had fun here.
We like to have good time.
I wish I knew better. I'll still have health insurance after this. That's what I'm saying.
Sophie, look.
There were a lot of things said at the end there, buddy.
I'm not going to give our followers bad advice about how to form their underground anti-government terrorist cell.
The question is, why aren't you giving that advice, Sophie?
Because I really having health insurance.
Well, I like making sure that some weird quiet kid doesn't wind up in charge after the revolution and murders
bit you've tens of millions ever of people. Done. I thought
Yes.
There's a lot of bits you could be a fan of.
Like
I've encouraged violence against so many deserving groups.
I hear what you're saying, and I know that you're like, well, I've done worse. And like you have, but I particularly hate
Sophie,
this.
Sophie's
like
tanky arc has begun tonight.
Did you like my
imitation
tonight. Of you?
Yeah. That was good.
This is, unfortunately, this was Sophie's choice to hate the thing.
Sophie's choice joke. We did it.
Get it?
We did
Get
the
it?
Whole.
That's
we did the whole thing.
And she has a Boston accent in that movie.
No.
Yep.
No.
So do I. Anyway, that's going to be the episode. Come back tomorrow. Well, not tomorrow, but soon.
Thursday.
And there will be more Ceausescu, less Romanian history, more. Getting into the weeds of Ceausescu. So stick around for that, folks. It ends in tens of thousands of starving orphans.
As it always does.
Behind the Bastards is a production of Cool Zone Media. For more from Cool Zone Media, visit our website, coolzonemedia.com, or check us out on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Do you dream of a healthier life, but education feels out of reach? Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School of Natural Health makes holistic education accessible with online programs to fit your busy schedule. Trinity School's Certified Natural Health Professional Program is the perfect entry point to gain foundational knowledge to empower yourself, your family, and your community to live healthier lives. Turn your passion into a career. Visit trinityschool.org for more info now.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.